Welcome to this episode of Watch the Media. I'm John Schrader. Our special guest this time around is the radio voice of the NFL champion Los Angeles Rams. The last minute of the last game of J.B. Long's sixth season doing Rams football on LA radio sounded like this.
Matthew Stafford under center. Here's the snap, here's the knee. The Bengals will not call a timeout. The sidelines empty. Rings for the Rams. A Lombardi Trophy for Los Angeles. 23-20 is the final on their home field here at SoFi Stadium in Super Bowl 56. The Los Angeles Rams are world champions.
There are just two really simple, prominent tracks. On the football side, how can we win championships? And on the business side, how can we grow our audience with an eye towards the future of that audience?
Cooper Kupp and Ben Skowronek out to the right. Van Jefferson and Bryson Hopkins, tight left. Stafford from under center, steps back, throws the fade, back shoulder, Cooper Kupp's got it! Cooper Kupp brings it in! Touchdown! Touchdown! Touchdown, LA!
The Rams have had a very interesting ride throughout multiple cities and regions, but they are not the Dodgers and they are not the Lakers, and we know that as an organization, but those franchises, I think, give us a model and something to aspire to. And as much as my role is on air, when I was hired, I think it was with the intention of how can you help us grow the next generation of Rams fans.
Coming up on Watch the Media, the voice of the Rams, J.B. Long. The voice of the Super Bowl champion, Los Angeles Rams. And I know that you didn't put any pads on, JB, but you certainly can revel in that. JB Long, how does it feel to be introduced like that?
Still a bit awkward, but whenever I'm talking to Professor Schrader, I guess it's awkward to begin with because I always thought of you as just John, but if we're going to be formal about it, I guess I should match your formalism. But no, it's great. It's a team accomplishment, and there's a lot of people in the organization that I'm very, very happy for. As I told you offline, I still don't have a good answer or response to the congratulations I've received as if I had anything to do with it, but it sure was fun to go along for the ride. And I think it's taught me that when they say the cliche that it's all about the journey, it really is, because we've had some seasons that have fallen short of the playoffs, and those were painful and tough to let go. But similarly, when you play to the very end and you get to be a part of the last game and even triumph and win it, there's still a period of mourning, I think, to let the season go and move on to the rest of your life and what is a truncated offseason.
So approaching the job and performing the job is no different. We all need to understand when you win four games or if you win the very last game of the season, The approach and the performance is the same, right?
I would agree with that. And I think football is unique too, in terms of its once per week cadence, right? It's probably a little bit different for a 162 game baseball season or an 80 plus game hockey or basketball season. But football, even if you are mired in a losing season, you still build towards that NFL Sunday, right? And there's also, because of the parity in the league, you're always 1 week away from feeling pretty good about things, even if you don't feel like it's going to be a championship campaign. And as many coaches, including ours here in Los Angeles, happen to say, humility is only 1 week away in the National Football League, even if you feel like you're a one seed or a Super Bowl contender. So the Rams experienced all of that this past season, a winless November, an undefeated December, and just about everything in between.
You're talking about your coach. It's not very often that the Super Bowl champion coach has to fend off rumors that the television networks are after him, right?
Yeah.
Which is another kind of unusual dynamic that's happened in your end of the world.
Yeah, sports media free agency is giving the players a run for their money. I wonder if we'll have to institute something in terms of a new league year for broadcasters or trade deadlines or whatever else needs to be put in place so that the networks can be prepared for a new season. I said on a different platform, I've never much understood the economics of our world, supply and demand being skewed as it is. I understand why these elite top tier talents attract the price tags that they do, I guess, but it would be tough for me to wrap my mind around, a realistic world where the commentator in the booth on a Sunday is making more than the potential Super Bowl winning coach who's in charge of calling the plays and actually executing and maybe winning the game that they're speaking about. But so it goes. And Sean McVay deserves those offers, those opportunities. And sooner or later, I'm sure he'll take one and do quite well at that too.
Yeah, the craziness of it is quantitative. When Bill Belichick makes the same amount of money as Tony Romo, Belichick to run the Patriots and Romo to talk about football 25 times a year. Yeah, it's crazy. Now, not everybody in the business is making $11, $12, $14 million a year like coaches, some of the coaches. But if Troy Aikman's worth $18 million, then the world is always is way off kilter in my view. So,
Just about every football coach I've ever met has had a cot of some sort in his office, like you and I have in our backdrop. If you're watching this interview, I've yet to meet a broadcaster who works so hard, or she works so hard, that would require living quarters in the offsite office.
All right, to reset a little bit here, JB made a remark earlier about Professor and John. I've known JB since he was in high school, since he and my son were in high school together. My son's a year older, and they played baseball together in high school in San Jose, California. So I've kind of kept my eyes on JB through his Notre Dame years and through the rest of his career. Mm-hmm. And I'm delighted to see that things are going so well for you, and in some sense proud of you for all the things you've been able to accomplish. So congratulations. So we got that disclaimer out of the way. So it's not just a couple of guys chatting who just met online a couple of minutes ago. So.
No, it's not. In fact, there's another piece to that puzzle. Kevin Franzen, who was part of that Bellarmine baseball squad back in the early 2000s, is now the color analyst for the Washington Nationals. I exchanged messages with Kevin the other day and told him it's not fair that he already beat me to the Bellarmine Athletic Hall of Fame, which I'll never attain or reach, but he's also going to beat me in the Broadcasting Hall of Fame, and that's probably deserved too.
Now, he's in the San Jose State Hall of Fame as well, so I don't know. Maybe you can get in the Notre Dame Hall of Fame one of these days.
No, my donation checks aren't robust enough, I'm sure.
So, yeah, Kevin, I talk with Kevin semi-regularly as well, and when they do play baseball, he's gotten to another level. So congratulations to him. So where, JB, did this broadcast journey start for you?
Probably at the end of that prep athletic career that we described. It had been such a prevalent part of my life for so long that I think going to college, I knew that my playing career was rightly over, but needed a way to tap into that adrenaline rush and to get my fix semi-regularly. And I think that's part of the reason why, the prep school that your son and I attended made sense, is because it had that rah-rah environment. Similarly with Notre Dame, where I think athletics are central to the student experience. And so just as an extracurricular, to this day, I don't remember if it was a career fair or just kind of a stumble upon. Found the student radio station, needed something to do with all of this spare time that I had never had on my hands, going through youth athletics and whatnot. And by I think my sophomore year had become the sports director, mostly by default, mostly for a lack of competition or other interest. And that allowed me to massage the system to the extent where I could assigned myself to travel to road games at the Big House in Neyland in Tennessee and the Coliseum in Los Angeles and call the road games, and then give some poor underclassmen the home games so that I could tailgate with my friends. And that was largely the setup and the intention, and figured that would be all it ever was. But I happened to be doormates with Charlie Ebersol, the son of legendary sports executive Dick Ebersol, instrumental in the Olympics and the television coverage of the Olympics that we now are so familiar with. And so rather than doing my finance investment banking internship like I should have been doing between my junior and senior year, I went to Athens and worked the Olympics with NBC. And I came back from that probably with my heart in a different place, but still forging ahead on the finance front until a bank in Chicago called my bluff and said, you don't really want to do this. Why don't you go chase what your heart desires? And if it doesn't work, you can come back and get your MBA and we'll give it another go. So one of the many business cards, maybe the business card I wish I had held on to most in my life. Sooner or later, that individual or those individuals are going to hear one of these shows, one of these podcasts, and say, that was me. I was the one who set you on a different course. Start giving me some royalties and some commissions. While I had, you know, no other responsibilities, was responsible to no one else in my early 20s, I figured I'd give it a shot, try and make it work, try and fool them for as long as I could. And almost two decades later, so far, so good.
So the banking business throws you out and shows you the way, and here you are. And so the Notre Dame relationship, the NBC and the Notre Dame relationship, mm-hmm. I think is worth looking into for a minute here, because I mean, you happen to be a doormate with Ebersol's son, and there's a connection right there. Mm-hmm. But Notre Dame and NBC has a relationship. There are a lot of Notre Dame people who work at NBC, and one of the reasons is Dick Ebersol. That has to be, that Notre Dame connection is invaluable, is it not, to young people that want to work in this business? And you sort of have said, I kind of got lucky and I went to Athens and I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of people who are getting those opportunities because of that relationship, aren't there?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. And also the association with General Electric and some of the other business career opportunities that I was exposed to as a student, I think tie into that kind of career path. I will say Notre Dame has a great tradition of broadcasters, despite not having a traditional broadcasting or sports journalism department like Syracuse or Missouri or Northwestern, some of the other ones, Arizona State, that have produced a lot of really good broadcasters. And I think that, as much as anything, that network of mentors is what assisted me. I wouldn't say necessarily in the hiring process, though there have been some instances of that, but more just being able to call upon a Ted Robinson, a Bob Fitzgerald, a couple of others, and very early on put my material in front of them and say, look, I'm not getting in classroom feedback on this. Will you be my informal professor? And learning from the pros in that exchange of constructive criticisms, and also how to go about your craft, how to prepare, how to conduct yourself on and off the air. I think those influences were really, really strong. And I guess proud to be a part of that Notre Dame tradition, which now includes, you know, Mike Monaco and some others. I don't want to, you know, try and remember everyone's name, but I think for lack of a pipeline, Notre Dame's done really well in that regard. And to go back to where I started, I think a lot of it is just purely on-campus opportunity. Maybe this is no longer unique or even something that stands out among other competitive, let's say high major institutions with FBS football programs, but the ability to call every single Notre Dame football game home away postseason on the Notre Dame athletic website, like maybe that didn't draw great ratings, but that is still one of the great career opportunities I've ever had, even though I wasn't drawing a paycheck for it. Like the goal of calling Notre Dame football, I think, is one that many people aspire to in our field. And I got to do it, somewhat a backdoor fashion and in a less publicized way. But still, my first play-by-play demo had Notre Dame USC on it, had Reggie Bush on it. And so that's a leg up in a different way.
Not to get too far off the topic about broadcasting, but do you see Notre Dame ever having to fall into the ACC football world completely?
Probably the next iteration of whatever the college football playoff is going to be could have some say in that. I think if they've managed to make it this far, and if they've become, I think, a player on the national championship stage again with their, you know, relationship with the ACC, though not fully fledged in football, maybe, hopefully not. But you know, other forces beyond their control could dictate that to them. For instance, what about this alliance between the Big Ten, the ACC, and the Pac-12? How does that impact scheduling realities for the likes of SC and Stanford and some others in the Big Ten who Notre Dame has relied upon for steady, competitive, high exposure football relationships? If those become conflicting, or if those institutions have to go in other directions to achieve, you know, their competitive and financial goals, where might that leave the Fighting Irish? That's way above my pay grade, but it would be surprising to see Notre Dame as a fully fledged conference member before you and I decide to hang it up.
Well, at least, but probably not before I decide to hang it up, but maybe before you decide to hang it up, that's for sure.
Oh, but I'll be an early retiree.
Oh, yeah, yeah. What I do find interesting is the idea that NBC might be in the game to broadcast Big Ten games. And one of the attractions of that is the regional interest, although Notre Dame's not a regional interest, it's a national interest, but the sort of regional interest to tie the Big Ten network into the games that NBC broadcasts with Notre Dame. I find that to be interesting. And the kind of money I've heard through the grapevine or been reported is pretty incredible, actually, to pay what, $1.1 billion is, from what I've heard, the offer to carry Big Ten games on NBC.
I'm sure there'll be at least one game per season that drives us all to Peacock, though, to pay for our streaming subscription. At least that's the trend.
I'm guessing that before I hang it up and before you hang it up, it'll be more than one game they force you to watch on Peacock, that's for sure. J.B. Long is the voice of the Los Angeles Rams, the radio voice of the Los Angeles Rams. Of course, the television voice of the Rams varies from week to week, depending on what network and who the announcers are. Also works for Pac-12 networks and does various games on Fox occasionally and Westwood One. And so how do you manage all of this? How do you manage the schedule?
Look, John, you know what we do is not hard. It's not serious. There's never a patient on our table. There's never, you know, someone's livelihood on our courtroom docket. But to the extent that it is a challenge, I've always thought it's the preparation that provides that challenge. And it's something that I've been pretty territorial about. I've been reluctant to outsource. It's something that thankfully I still enjoy and take ownership of and feel like is one of my few differentiating factors that's allowed me to achieve the modicum of progress and success that I have. So for me, I think it's knowing yourself. It's knowing what you need to do as a broadcaster to make you comfortable and well-versed for the time that you're on the air. And there have been days where I felt like I had done so much homework that I was ready to ace the test and I could do the game forward and backward no matter what played out. And there have been other times where it felt like, unfortunately, flying a bit without a parachute. And that's terrifying. It's uncomfortable and it doesn't always lead to my best product. Depending on what's on the schedule, how familiar I am with the teams, the players, the league, the state of the season, all that, you know, fluctuates and is pretty variable. But my goal is always to know the game, the players in the game, everything associated with the game, as well as the fans who follow those teams and that league and that sport would. Is that always an attainable goal by Tuesday at 7 o'clock Pacific time? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. But I feel like our audience is owed that effort on our behalf. And so I work at as much as possible. To the extent that I can anticipate my schedule, I do everything from setting up, news feeds, Google alerts, Twitter lists, build my boards well in advance. Sometimes you can't stay ahead. Sometimes it feels like you're sprinting to stay in place or even falling behind. But I find that the more that I can be ahead of my calendar, the better chance I have of devoting the necessary hours to it, no matter what life throws at you. And let's face it, life is throwing more and more at each of us, especially during this season where, you know, you're only one phone call away from having a child home from kindergarten all week unexpectedly and needing to account for that and all the other sorts of things that are chewing up our bandwidth, many of which are our champagne problems, our blessings, and ones that I'm happy to overcome.
So I know NFL announcers who try to keep the NFL season in the NFL and try not to get too distracted by doing a lot of other work during the NFL season. Is that the way you approach it?
Not necessarily. I think my role being a team announcer is a little bit different. I almost said that it makes for one team preps each week, which isn't true. I don't have to learn many new Rams week to week, though I do update their storylines, their statistics, and do a whole other array of Rams related duties, from putting together hype trailers to writing articles to hosting coaches shows and player podcasts and those sorts of things. But in terms of ramping up on an opponent, the NFL for me is pretty straightforward, because it's often one team per week. Many of those teams I'm familiar with already. I know the San Francisco 49ers, not forward and backward, but the skeleton of the 49ers pretty well by the second or even third time we played them this season. Also, what's different about the NFL is, as you know, is, you know, these are household names. If you can't tell Aaron Rodgers from Jimmy Garoppolo, you're probably not qualified to be in your seat. And unlike college football, where you're always potentially one coach's decision away from having, you know, the walk-on fifth-year senior make his debut in the midst of the third quarter unexpectedly, the NFL, there are 53 on the roster. There are 48 active on game day. Only a certain number of them could potentially ever come anywhere close to touching the football. So if you know you're too deep, if you know your top couple of running backs, your two or three tight ends, your handful of receivers, you've got the gist of it at the outset of each week, and the rest is kind of just filling in the blanks.
Yeah, I've always felt that the higher up you go on the chain, the more money you make, but also the more responsibilities you have. But in the NFL, you're right, there's 20 cameras in the stadium, so you don't ever miss anything on the monitor. There are 48 guys on the field, and there are 32 teams you have to keep track of. So while the pressure on your performance goes way up, the preparation is not, I won't say it's as intense. So I'm sort of trying to summarize what you were saying, but it's not as intense, but the skin in the game is a lot higher.
Sure. Yeah, I don't think it's as labor intensive because of how well it's covered and how much is there. I think the challenge is synthesizing it, right? How do you distill, oh, I find that interesting, to how do I convey that, especially on radio, in a way that is digestible and that translates to an audience that might be driving from church to the grocery store and only listening with one ear while you're trying to make sure that you cover the down distance time score appropriately. So, yeah, I think seeing the forest through the trees is an attribute that has allowed me to kind of maintain the cadence while also pursuing some other things that I love to do, like college football and basketball and other things in between.
Shotgun with P-Line to the right of Burrow. Less than a yard to gain on fourth down with 43 seconds remaining. Rams creepy. They rush forward. Burrow to throw for it. He's hit. He's hit. He's sacked. He throws it away. He flings it away on fourth down. Aaron Donald got there. Donald takes his helmet off in celebration. He flips Burrow to the turf and forces the incompletion on fourth and one. He signals to his ring finger on his left hand. And you can build that man's statue out SoFi Stadium right now. The greatest of all time on defense does it in the biggest moment of Super Bowl 56.
Characterize for us, if you would, the relationship that the fans develop with the team's announcer. 6 years now, you've been the radio voice of the Rams.
Yeah.
Help characterize for us the relationship that develops among the fans with you and your partner.
Well, it's one that I cherish. And those who have supported me, I can never say enough how much I appreciate it, right? Because even though I try not to seek or rely upon external affirmation, like I try and be my own honest evaluator of my work product, believe me, it's meaningful when people say complimentary things or sentimental things that make me feel like the work I'm doing does have some value add. Because believe me, I'm keenly aware that at the end of the day, all I've really done is use my voice to talk about football in a manner that I probably would be paying to do if not employed to do it, right? So I try not to take myself too seriously while also being very serious about my craft, if that makes sense. And so the relationship that then I form with the people who become accustomed to and rely upon and are really invested in my product, our product, is essential to me. And I do have and have benefited from the advantage of a horizon. When you drop in for a 3-hour affair, it's tough to make a connection with anyone in any setting, much less as a broadcaster. But when you can do it for 3 years or 6 years, like I've been fortunate enough to do, and when your audience can see your affinity for what they care about and your investment in the product that they devote a lot of their time, energy, and resources to, I think inevitably that bond forms. And so it's no coincidence that those who do it in earnest, who do it in good faith, and who do it with longevity, to the extent that that label, the voice of, is true and applies, I think the bond between the audience and the broadcaster is what generates that and fosters that.
When you got seriously into the sports broadcasting business, was doing the NFL an aspiration that you had?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it definitely was. I'm very much a believer in aspirations and goals and being diligent and intentional about pursuing them, but I can't say that my goals have necessarily led me to where I am and the opportunities I've been blessed to have, if that makes sense. I've never written down on a grease board, you know, by this age, I want to be here or accomplish this. I mean, there's things that sound, you know, really interesting and that I aspire to. But I think because of how I came to the game and also because of just who I am as a person, what I mean by that is generally more understated, introspective, an introvert, not someone who cannot fight the urge to talk about sports and statistics and tell everyone everything they know about the game that's on TV. I think I've just been a little bit more understated and passive in my pursuit of those things. That's not to say that I can't network and that I can't make my feelings known and I can't advocate for myself. Certainly I do. But I guess I've just never been that bold or ambitious about my place in the pecking order or what I hope to achieve. But yes, calling an NFL Sunday, I'd be lying if I said that wasn't an end game for me. And even within professional sports, to be doing football has also made my family world go round. Like, I marvel at my peers who do baseball and other things and somehow manage to be good mothers and fathers and spouses. You know, I think the way that our family operates, it would be hard for us to endure a full baseball season, where I feel very fortunate that football is kind of on the academic year, which works for my kids, is once a week, though there's certainly ancillary responsibilities as we've documented that make it a weekly and a year-round job. But especially from the travel standpoint, to have your, let's say, 20 game schedule chopped in half, 10 of those games at home, only 10 on the road. Most of those trips are manageable and short compared to the 12 game roadies that my broadcasting peers in baseball go on. Yeah, if I could go back and tell my college age self as I get into this, what should you be aspiring to? The NFL would be at the top of that list.
You mentioned you're from Northern California and you grew up there and now you're working in Southern California. Describe for me and for us the difference culturally and in a sports realm between Northern and Southern California.
Well, I think first I have to say I was born in Torrance and my roots are in Los Angeles, though I was raised largely in Northern California in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I think going both directions, perception is not reality. But what else would you expect from a sports and cultural rivalry and stereotypes and myths that are perpetuated amongst all of us? You know, I've been overwhelmingly thrilled and pleased with what Los Angeles is as a sports culture, but mostly as a community. And we were reluctant to leave what we had in San Francisco, of course, with a young family and great friends. But instantaneously, Los Angeles surpassed anything that we could have hoped for and quickly became home. Now, does your W-2 have a lot of say in that matter? Of course. Who hires you and who pays you is one of the most influential things when it comes to loyalty. But I can honestly say that Los Angeles felt like home right away and has now become the place where we've lived longer than any other stop. So it depends which team you're talking about in terms of sports fandom and sports culture. The Rams have had a very interesting ride throughout multiple cities and regions, but they are not the Dodgers and they are not the Lakers. And we know that as an organization, but those franchises, I think, give us a model and something to aspire to. And as much as my role is on air, when I was hired, I think it was with the intention of how can you help us grow the next generation of Rams fans? And 6 years in, that's something that I think we're doing very well and making steady, if not accelerated, progress towards. But that's something that I think will be judged ultimately, not after 6 years, but when I am 60 and my boys are potential, you know, seat license holders and season ticket members and wear apparel and take their children to Rams games and their colleagues and all those sorts of things. So long way to go still to match what, you know, the 49ers have in San Francisco as the parallel.
I know I was neither born nor raised in Northern or Southern California, but I lived in Northern California for 31 years. And then we lived in Southern California for 6 years. And I was surprised at all of the, I wasn't surprised, but I was intrigued by all of the really interesting, cool, multicultural, things to do in Southern California. But always, and I don't mean to be hyperbolic about it, JB, but always frustrated by the dilemma of how long it would take to get there, right? So you want to go to the Huntington, or you want to go to the Getty, or you want to go to the beach, or you want to go downtown, you want to go to Orange County, you want to go to Santa Barbara. You didn't know if it would take you an hour or 3 hours to get somewhere. Sure. And it drove me crazy. And I would always ask the natives, how long did it take you to get used to the traffic? And they would say, never. We never get used to the traffic. So
Yeah,
that's
right.
A cliche, but reality in my world, the traffic in LA
totally.
Is a cliche, but it's reality. It's a
yeah.
Real
I mean,
thing.
We consider Pasadena part of the greater Los Angeles area, but it might as well be a different state on a Tuesday night during rush hour, as far as I'm concerned. So, and I can't imagine doing Los Angeles pre cell phones and podcasts and audiobooks and all the other things that I try to utilize to make productive use of my time. There's another. I know this is not even relative to the conversation we're having, but a lot of my work week, I will get done in the car. Here's what I mean by that. Could be listening to an opposing broadcast team call their most recent game, get a feel for, you know, storylines, pronunciations, all those sorts of things. I will often record on my just voice messages. Like if there's a basketball roster, for instance, I've got Arizona tomorrow. Fortunately, I already know Arizona, but if I was doing Arizona for the first time, I'd record names, numbers, key resume bullet points. I just say those into my phone. And when I'm driving around the car for an hour today, picking up my kids from school, I'm listening to those and I'm practicing and I'm rehearsing and trying to just drill them between my ears so that I have them at the ready as quickly as possible tomorrow afternoon.
Yeah. What a great piece of advice for young broadcasters too, whether they're stuck in traffic or not. We try to convince them that they have to get into a ritual. They get into a routine. They learn how to prepare and then find your best way to prepare and then do that all the time and be faithful to it. And it'll make you so much better as you go along, as you get.
Sure. At least one day per week, my spin bike has, you know, iPad or a phone, and I'm watching the Seahawks or I'm watching the Cincinnati Bengals. I'm not a fan, a proponent of multitasking, but there are some things that I want to do in my daily rhythms and my weekly rhythms. And if I can overlap work on top of routine or to-dos,
right,
believe me, I do.
I'm John Schrader, and this is Watch the Media. We're joined by J.B. Long, who for 6 years now has been the radio voice of the Los Angeles Rams.
Hey, there's people listening to this right now who would say, and probably have been for the last several minutes, ask him about what it's like to work in SoFi Stadium. So, JB, what's it like to work in the newest, grandest cathedral in maybe world sport?
Well, I'm so proud of that facility and the way that it has brought Los Angeles and Rams fans and the NFL community together. If you have $5 billion laying around, it really is remarkable what that price point can get you, even in Los Angeles. So Stan Kroenke's vision has been spectacularly executed, and the way the stars aligned to host the LA Super Bowl and to have the Rams play their way into it this year, there'll never be anything like it again. I don't feel like I'm stretching to say that was a once in a lifetime opportunity, in the way that it really is genuinely meant, not in the way that we kind of toss it around. What I love about it, and I've struggled to say this in a way that doesn't sound demeaning to other new stadiums, because other new stadiums around the league are great. And they all come with their varying dynamics of, you know, local politics and resources, privately owned, publicly financed, all those sorts of things. But I think SoFi is distinctly Los Angeles. I think that if you dropped a non-sports fan or even a non-human being into Inglewood and say, where are we right now? I think Los Angeles would be a pretty ready, smart guess. And I think because of that, it'll stand the test of time really, really well. Where I was going with the other stadium comment is, there are some buildings that are new, but they don't have a defining characteristic. They don't make you marvel in awe. And I think SoFi has several of those dynamics going for it. The infinity screen being one that you've probably all seen, the architecture being another. It's space in Los Angeles where it's right in the middle of two flight paths, so you can't help but see it from above when you enter or leave Los Angeles. All those sorts of things are just remarkably unique, and also came with unique challenges. Like, how do you get the FAA to sign off on a 70,000 seat stadium just a couple of miles from one of the world's biggest international airports? Well, the answer was you build it six levels underground. And that also makes it, I think, one of the most accommodating, accessible, and loudest because of all those factors.
You know, this is not intended to sound like LA, but I really believe this, that in Los Angeles, and maybe in New York, if they were to do it again and actually build a stadium in New York. But I think in Los Angeles, the entertainment capital of the world, you have to have a stadium like that. It has to be a massive, beautiful, awesome cathedral for entertainment. And in Los Angeles, I think it has to be that way. Of course, Jerry Jones is really proud of Dallas's stadium, and there's others around. But I think in LA, they had to. $5 billion or not, they had to spend whatever it took to make that kind of a stadium, because it is Los Angeles. That's the way I look at it.
Well, you look at all the events that it will eventually attract and bring to Los Angeles, from the World Cup, hopefully, to the Olympics. And on top of that, yes, LA needed its own football stadium, but the Rams got to start back in their roots at the Coliseum, which was great and so memorable. And the parade was actually, you know, hosted right outside the peristyle end of the Coliseum. And I thought that was such a neat way to tie the football history of Los Angeles together. But even in that Inglewood footprint, in short order, you will now have the Forum, which is so rich and steeped in history and is now one of the premier concert venues in Los Angeles and the world. SoFi Stadium and Steve Ballmer's new, I think, Intuit Dome, where the Clippers will soon play. Those are all Professor Schrader driver away from each other. And there seems to be some overlap there, especially when you consider the YouTube theater that's part of SoFi Stadium. Like, what could possibly all this event space and music space and entertainment space be leveraged toward? And yet they've all got full books and they all have their own niches and target performers and performances and functions, and it all fits together really well.
Yeah. Well, and it also, I believe, represents what I think people don't think so much about professional football, professional sports, is that it really is the entertainment business. The NBA, the NFL, especially Major League Baseball, if they ever play again, might get back in the entertainment business. But it really is that, and the places they play and the shows they put on need to represent that, the way I see it.
Yeah, no, I think that matters. And especially when you are the Rams and you're trying to attract and engage the existing audience, yes, but also long-term that next wave, how do you inspire them and make it feel like their in-person investment, time, energy, patience, financial, et cetera, is worth it, is differentiated from all the other options that you've touched on in Los Angeles. You know, my wife and I had the privilege of bringing guests to each game this year. My wife and five-year-old went to every game and they got to bring friends with them. And each one of them, I was actually thinking about this the other day, was seeing SoFi Stadium for the very first time and was going to a Rams game for the very first time. And so as fun as it is now after 2 years to still go there every week, every day, whatever it ends up being, the real privilege, the real joy is seeing it for the first time through someone else's eyes. And that's an experience that I think when you build a special place like that is one that we all get to enjoy over and over and over again.
Something that struck me, you said, JB, here in the last few minutes of this conversation, is the next generation of fans. You talked about we need to appeal to the next generation of Rams fans. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons you think they hired you and one of your jobs when they hired you to do this. I don't know that we think about that too much. And I'm not sure everybody in the business thinks about reaching the next fan. The NFL's on top of the world. It's like the greatest league in the world. The revenues that the NFL have now are better than any sports league and most businesses in the world, right? But they're always thinking about the next. The NBA is trying to figure out the next and where it is around the world, right? Maybe Major League Baseball is, but they don't seem to be doing a very good job of it because the young people are kind of falling away from baseball. But I think it's important, isn't it, for us to think about what's next and where we go from this, even if you are the NFL and you're on top of the world.
I mean, I can only speak organizationally. This is the one professional sports entity that I've been a part of and get to be privy to, you know, the internal dialogues, the town halls, the emails, the vision casting. And there are just two really simple, prominent tracks. On the football side, how can we win championships? And on the business side, how can we grow our audience with an eye towards the future of that audience? And, you know, you want every moment to be world-class, from wayfinding to concessions to the product on the field and everything in between. Only so much of that can be controlled by each individual in their various roles. But I think part of the reason why it's so captivating for me to be a member of the Rams organization at this time, look, I'm not a world-class broadcaster. They could have hired anyone. And if they were to open up my job again, I probably wouldn't even make it through the first round of applications. But what I love digging into, especially as the father of two young boys, is how do we tailor our product to inspiring them and to appealing to them? And while being cognizant and careful of not pushing my boys towards athletics, period, much less professional football or my own passions, I don't want to graft those onto them. I want them to pick their lane. It is affirming, I think, to see their entire elementary school waving Rams rally towels on the Friday before the Super Bowl, right? Like those are the types of mile marker wins that I think as an organization we're right to celebrate while the coaches and players and staff are doing their thing in the competitive venue.
Pocket crumbling. He spins out. He's hit. He's wrapped up. He flips it forward. It's tipped. It's intercepted. It's intercepted. It's intercepted. Aaron Donald got pressure on Garoppolo, and Traven Howard clinches the NFC Championship game. San Francisco is heading home. The Rams are staying home to play in Super Bowl 56.
You are in a generation of broadcasters, media producers that have stepped across from what we used to do and what we're we're now doing and to what we're going to do. We've all been that way, but the last decade or so has been an explosion, a big bang of media. What would you tell a 19 or 20 year old who wanted to be in the sports business, or who walked in the radio station because he had free time on his hands and became the sports director of the station? What would you tell him or her about what they should be doing at 20 years of age to become a professional?
Yeah, I think curating your material is the first thing that comes to mind, because little did I know that those games I was doing in South Bend during my sophomore year would become kind of the foundation for my first resume reel, right? And that none of the work that I was doing in the classroom, though edifying and I think helpful to my overall personality and growth, was going to have any bearing on my professional opportunities. And so I think now, especially when the camera is only an iPhone or equivalent away, there's no need to wait. There's no need to ask for opportunities that can be created organically. And for my generation or yours, what might have been sitting in a minor league baseball stadium with a recorder and pretending to be Vin Scully, think of where that is now, where you can essentially take a, you know, an inning of Dodgers baseball, copyrighted or otherwise, and call it in a much more robust visual fashion, so that any hiring manager doesn't have to imagine, okay, what might this sound like if he or she was given the opportunity? They can know. They really can know. And so that's one direction that my mind wanders. The other is, unless and until you are truly elite and at the pinnacle, specialization is kind of a privilege. And I would encourage anyone to be good at and to offer much more than the time that you are on the air. I know that's the only reason I've been able to advance, is not purely on the merits of my on-air performance, but on all the ancillary things that I think I can offer relative to my peers or in competition with my peers, many of whom I will readily admit are more skilled and deliver better products than I do. So maybe that's writing. Maybe that's social media creation. Maybe that's finding a new business element that you can pioneer and be in charge of and sell yourself that way. I know this is a long and rambling answer, but I think that's the very nature of what comes next and how do we anticipate the future. Is if I had a 30-second response to that one, all due respect, I wouldn't be here, you know, trying to think through it. I would be doing it. I would be capitalizing on it. So I think it's those types of thought exercises that are, how do I anticipate where this is going? And that means reading the trade news and following the trends, and also being introspective. What skill set do I have that can either generate a new branch of this or accelerate an entity's growth in this area? What's my value added in their ambitions with where their field, their network is going next?
Yeah. When you view your job as the voice of the Rams, and there are people in Los Angeles who listen to you, but they also listen to you all over the world, how do you make sure that the people who can listen to you all over the world and aren't Rams fans, but like John Schrader driving around in his car listening to Sirius XM and listening to your game, that you make sure that you touch all of your diehard Rams fans and also have respect for the people who are not?
Well, I think that's been one of the great challenges of this role is, as listeners may or may not be aware, like they were the Los Angeles Rams and then they were the St. Louis Rams for, you know, a couple of decades and a championship run, some really successful years. And then they came back to Los Angeles. And so a good portion of our fan base now conflicts. I don't mean to say that they're at odds, but there are longstanding Los Angeles Rams fans that regret the season of life where the Rams were not here in LA. And there are St. Louis fans who followed that franchise very passionately, who have understandably mixed feelings about where the organization is now and the way that it brands itself and the way that broadcasters like me describe touchdowns as LA centric rather than Rams centric, and maybe are not as inclusive. So there's some rub there. And I think acknowledging that and being transparent about that is fine. And it's the only way to accomplish the inclusivity that I think you're referencing. And nothing seriously brings me greater joy and awe than getting like an Instagram message from Scotland, or whatever the equivalent might be, that makes you realize when, you know, when we play abroad, and we've gone to London a couple of times, we've had Rams fan events at a, you know, a downtown London pub, and to see the swath of people that not only follow the Rams, but are willing to stay up until all hours of the night or morning to watch a game live, or to pay money to travel to be there in person when you do move incrementally closer to them geographically. It's inspiring. I mean, it really is heartwarming. And sports are inevitably tied to a region or a city. There's a reason why, you know, the city comes first and the moniker next, the mascot next. But more and more, I mean, we could go through endless examples. You know, how many Steph Curry fans are there from outside the greater Bay Area, right? How many Kobe Bryant fans? All these transcendent sports stars, whether it's individuals, coaches, or franchises, if you're not thinking globally right now as a sports entity, obviously you've missed the wave. And there's good reasons why the Rams and other NFL teams bid on these international marketing rights, why Los Angeles, the Rams, are interested in captivating Australia and East Asia and other parts of the world, because there are potential fans there and there are existing fans there.
In turn, I'm happy that we and us and ours doesn't fall into the lexicon, because that's one of the things that drives me nuts is play-by-play guys who will say, even though the paycheck shows up and it's nice and you're there in the office doing things for the team, sure, it's not your job to say we and us and ours, at least in my view. And I appreciate that.
Yeah, I think that all the greats that I model myself after or try to emulate, it's always so clear where their heart rests, but they don't need to claim any credit or affiliation verbally on the air. Now, there'll be times where, you know, I reference we or us,
sure,
with respect to the Rams in an informal off-air setting amongst friends and family and those sorts of things, where it would be almost awkward to disassociate from the Rams, of course. But in a professional capacity on air, you know, maybe I'm wearing the polo shirt that shows who I'm affiliated with, but I'm not a part of any game plan. I'm certainly not a part of any game day execution. And I also, I think, had the privilege of going through a rough first season, a 4-12 season to begin my career, because one, it saved me from some of the Johnny come lately accusations. I earned stripes in a very limited amount of time, but it was also a good cautionary tale. You know, how do you maintain that professional distance? Because there are going to be great years and there's going to be tough years. And if you want to claim we while you're on top of the world, you better be willing to claim we when you're bringing up the seller.
One final thought from you. I like to ask this question. What is the best part about this job? What is the part about this job that you say, wow, I wouldn't want to lose that part of this job for anything in the world?
So I think as I compare it to my other professional alternatives, the blessing and the curse of broadcasting as a performance art is, you know, in real time how well you've done. And that hurts sometimes. And there have been a lot of junctures, including the Super Bowl, where I would have loved to have been on a quarterly cycle and had another week or month to work on my slide deck and tweak it and perfect it and revise it. And that's not the world we live in. So when you capitalize on one of those moments and you know that, you know, the extra hour of study or the angle that you originated or the preparation that you did to anticipate a moment, or just the sheer investment that you've laid down over the course of a season pays off, that's really fulfilling. And it's cool that it happens for the world to see, right? Like the selfish, vain part of me does enjoy that. But my goodness, there are times where I crave the anonymity too. And I think giving that up would be a reprieve in some senses, but I think I would really, really miss that if I had to wait once per year for a performance review. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I think you use the word, the performance art of it. And clearly this is a craft and it's an art, right? You can't be an artist until you've learned the craft, I think. And once you've learned the craft and the basics and the fundamentals and the just the simple things like speaking in present tense and relationship with the audience and understanding that you're talking with one person in the audience and having a conversation, but you're the authority in that conversation. All of the craft fundamental basic parts of it, I think, allow then the art of it. And some days when you take the headset off and you say, wow, I can't believe I just got to do that. And maybe when Jackson Pollock threw the paint on the wall and said, yeah, that's what I wanted, or Gauguin or Pavarotti or something, and they walk off the stage and say, that's what I was working for the last month, and I hit it. And and that feels awfully good, doesn't it? That's what you're saying.
It does. And I think it also provides endless opportunity to be refreshed and to try again. And I don't know, because I haven't experienced them, how many other fields, offer that opportunity. And the hard part about a season coming to an end is it's going to be months before I get to call a Rams football game again. And that pains me, because I crave that opportunity. And believe me, it feels very confined and regimented, because it's four quarters and there's only so many players who can participate and so many outcomes that can happen. And yet, sports has this transcendent ability to continually provide us with something we've never seen or experienced before. And how can you be ready for that moment? How can you capture that moment? And how can you incrementally move closer to a perfect game? However many over six seasons, I sure have not had one. I don't anticipate I ever will. But the optimism that abounds with each spring training that we're robbed of currently, I think holds true for a sports broadcaster too, where if you are confident, or if you are contractually guaranteed another opportunity, man, that's tough to replace. I can't imagine very many other professions or pursuits provide that renewing future.
That is a fabulous way to end the conversation. Thank you. It's always fun to chat about these things, and especially with someone who I've known for quite a while, back in teenage days. And so thanks again. I appreciate it.
No, what's cool about these conversations is I know you have just a rich appreciation for those who pursue it in earnest and treat it as a craft. And that's the other cool thing too is, yeah, I think other professions, you have peers and you have competitors, but do you get to see their product laid bare over and over and over again? Not necessarily as a measuring stick, but with admiration and appreciation for how good you have to be and how hard you have to work to deliver products like those. I think it's really special. The community that I've been fortunate to be a part of, I think you share those sentiments. Yeah. So thanks for including me.
Yeah, thank you. And I know I signed it off a minute ago here, but whenever there's a critic who gets in my face about broadcasting, I will just say, look, the people who think broadcasting is easy are those who have never tried it, right? And it's work. It's fun. It's a job, but it is also something that gets in you and is in you. And if you want to be really good at it, you work really hard at it. And you can tell, can't you? The people who work hard at it are the ones who kind of make it sound easier than others.
Sure. Sure. That they hit on a higher percentage. Their batting average is better than everyone else's. Yeah. But I always struggle not to agree with critics, right? Because I think even the ones that tend to be a little bit heavy-handed, there's more than a grain of truth. And when I listen to my own product, I hear what they're saying, and I can agree with that, and I can strive for and want better too. So it's not easy, but it is a place of privilege, and I think we owe it to our audience to always strive for better and best.
There you go. Well, thank you, JB. I appreciate it.
Good to see you. Thank you for setting this up.
Thank you. JB Long is the voice of the Los Angeles Rams as Pac-12 Network. You might hear him on Westwood One occasionally, maybe Fox Sports. He's there in Southern California for half a dozen seasons, and his team won the Super Bowl in 2022.